What you have before you is Book 6 of the Institutes, Cassian's description of the logismos, the temptation to unchastity, to lust. Now, he calls it fornicatio, and of course, that does refer to sexual actions that are inappropriate and unlawful, but he is primarily concerned with the experience of the temptation rather than the action, which the English word fornication more specifically refers to. And as we'll see, this word for him is his way of describing the whole inner world of being tempted to unchastity. I should mention that this translation is an amalgam of several different modern translations. You will not find this book of the Institutes translated in the Ante-Nicene Fathers series. It was deleted, it was eliminated from the Victorian translation, together with Conferences 12 and Conference 22. Because these conferences, not just because they deal with the subject of sexual temptation, which the Victorians would have found a little bit daring, but also because they deal with the issue of nocturnal emissions, the typically male experience, exclusively male experience, that even for the person who is not sexually active, there will be occasionally the experience of a dream associated with an emission of semen, and sometimes with an experience of orgasm. And to even mention this in antiquity and in Victorian times, let alone deal in a very rational and reasonable way with the issue, was just too much for the Victorian translators. And so it's only been in the last 10 years that there have been available in English full translations of these texts. This particular text from Book 6 of the Institutes is rather general and touches on that issue which made people so squeamish in the past. Conferences 12 and 22, which we won't be looking at in detail, look at that question more specifically. And of course, it was an issue in moral theology, especially for monks who were concerned whether, if they'd had a nocturnal emission, that meant that they were, for example, not supposed to go to communion. It had moral implications for them. And the Desert Fathers attempted to deal, and many of them did deal with this, in a very reasonable kind of way. As we'll see, especially when we look at the texts from Brown, Cassian and the whole of the Desert tradition believed that one's inner experience of sexual attraction, although it certainly does represent a potential for misbehavior or for wrong behavior, is primarily an indication of what's going on within the heart. One's fantasy life describes the question of one's integration of spirituality and one's life in the body, one's experience of God, and one's life in the world. It's a kind of window, or we might even say a psychological instrument, that tells us what's going on in the deeper levels of the heart. So that underlying philosophy and theology underlies everything that Cassian has to say about this subject. We'll also see that in Brown, he emphasizes how different Cassian's and the Desert Fathers' conclusions are from that of Augustine. Cassian and the Desert tradition believe that genuine progress in the experience of recovering an integrated sense of chastity, of one's desire, was possible over time. Augustine was much less optimistic on that subject, as we'll see when we look at the text from Brown's Body and Society. But here we have Cassian's sixth book of the Institutes on the spirit of fornication, or on the spirit of lust. I've divided it up into sections which include my own little brief commentary or introduction, which are contained in those blue bars. And so I'll be referring to them as we now glance rather rapidly through this text, noticing just a few highlights. In the first section, chapters 1 to 2, notice that Cassian emphasizes that there isn't any single or simple remedy for the experience of sexual temptation or temptation that's inappropriate. The whole of the spiritual life has to be, I've said, activated, has to be put into effect. And so he mentions in the highlighted and numbered portions at the end of chapter 1, we must have a contrite spirit, persevering in prayer, meditating on the scriptures. Notice in number 4, spiritual understanding. There must also be manual labor and true humility. Spiritual understanding, or spiritual knowledge, which is another way one could translate that, is a very high attainment. It's something that comes after years of reflecting on the nature of God and the nature of the world and one's own inner heart. So Cassian is saying that the growth towards a kind of a sense of integrity in the dimension of one's spiritual life connected with sexual feelings is something that that happens over a long, long period of time and is affected by and is affected by all of the spiritual practices and all of the kind of progress that one makes. So it's not just a single thing, it's connected with everything else. He particularly mentions holy meditation and spiritual study. Again, very rather far along on the list of things that one does once one first begins the ascetical life. These are things that will help enable one to understand one's own sexuality better and also to begin to make progress in making choices of and experiences about how to use this properly. The second blue bar that I've labeled solitude and community is the point that we also saw emphasized in Evagrius, that we should not be seeking out intimate relationships at the time that we're having the most difficulty dealing with relationships. Sometimes Evagrius said in a text we didn't notice in the Paralogus Bones, sometimes we just have to get out of ourselves and either flee the temptation and recognize that this is not the best time for me to be talking to people. And in the same way, Cashin says, sometimes solitudes and distance from others can be a very helpful remedy with this kind of problem. What he says in chapter 4 that I've highlighted in a blue bar is fascinating. Integrity, even once lost, can be regained. This is very helpful in looking at the desert tradition in which the whole virtue of virginity is extolled. This seems to exclude anyone who has had any kind of sexual experience or even been married before in their lives. That's not true. Cashin here is articulating the fact that virginity, or the state of, he calls it agneia, or being agnos, is a kind of, not just metaphor, but it is a goal, which may pertain to those who haven't had any sexual experience, but it is also a spiritual state that can be regained for those who are genuinely seeking to reintegrate, to live out in its own proper context their experience of spirituality. Spiritual virginity is not just something that has to do with physical or corporal virginity. It is a state of mind and heart that can be regained, even as he puts it, after an experience of corruption, even after something very significant or problematic has happened. Now, in chapters 5 to 8, he particularly emphasizes, and this is important, especially when we remember that Cashin was accused of being a semi-Pelagian in his controversy with Augustine, of emphasizing too much the power of human effort. Here in chapters 5 to 8 especially, Cashin emphasizes grace. We must place our confidence not in our own forces, he says in chapter 5 in the section that's highlighted in white, but on the help of God. God must help us. God gives us the grace of overcoming. It's not something we can do on our own efforts. And he says that again in chapter 6. We need the specific aid and gift of grace. It's impossible to attain success in this realm except by the grace of God. Now, he then goes on after saying this to emphasize that we have to look at the worldly games, those who are willing to engage in physical contests and who therefore are willing to engage in practice and training and exercise. We need to be willing to learn from them. It's not just sitting passively by and saying, I can do nothing, I must wait for the grace of God. I rely on the grace of God. I know I can't attain anything without it, and that grace enables my spiritual exercise and practice to bear good fruit. And that is particularly his emphasis in the next several chapters, chapters 7 to 8. In 9 to 12, I've highlighted or emphasized this in the blue bar as the interior contest for purity of heart. It really is an inner journey that is manifested by outward signs. And so in chapter 10, as we saw in Evagrius, but which Cashin particularly emphasizes, during sleep, if we find that we aren't having very, you know, problematic and erotic fantasies, and if we experience ourselves as not always or not frequently troubled by by sexual feelings or arousal, that this is a sense of or a hint of our making progress. Now, this would need to be nuanced, obviously, in the modern world, but there is a very deep insight here that what is going on in our unconscious minds and hearts and what we experience in our dreams and what we experience when we're half conscious is a part of our spiritual journey. It is data we need to be able to incorporate. And so Cashin and the Desert Fathers are perfectly calm about saying, well, how many times a year can nocturnal emissions occur? And this be normal according to nature, not necessarily be evidence of a person who's, you know, inappropriately fantasizing or something of that sort. And they come to a specific recommendation, and it depends on which conference or part of the institutes you read, but it's something like every couple of months or less frequently than that. Again, there are all sorts of physiological questions we could raise as moderns, but I think the point we need to take away from this is that the body is an instrument, a sign, a reminder of the inner spiritual journey. And moving on very quickly through the remainder of the section, number 13, he talks about the importance of the succession of interior fantasies, the tradition of not spending time with family or avoiding thoughts of members of the opposite sex. This is not so much an issue of the possibility of being tempted by that individual, but this setting up a train of fantasies, as we see in number 13, which could be problematic. And so we see in 13.2, this famous verse, which finds its way into the Rule of Benedict, smashing the Babylonian children, which is a violent image from the Psalms, but which is allegorically interpreted here as being aware of your temptations, and especially of your sexual temptations, at their first arising and dashing them on, as we'll see, on the rock that is Christ, although that's not exactly the phrase that he uses here. That's Benedict, and actually it's also Evagrius's contribution as well. If we drop then down to chapters 14, he borrows a number of sources who particularly praise the quest for interior chastity. He emphasizes in chapter 18 that humility and true knowledge are interrelated. Knowledge and chastity are integrally interrelated. The whole of the spiritual life is intertwined, and implicit within this is the idea that the quest for responsibility in one's sexual life goes on for the whole of one's life. And our bodies, as we see in chapter 20, what happens to us awake and asleep is an indicator, a sign of our own state on our inward journey.